Hey everybody, and welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, and Brooke Thomas is here.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. That was is here. I don't know. I'm gonna.
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
You don't know what that was. Okay,
because yeah,
I don't either.
And so
I was okay. Good. That's okay.
I've got two of them.
Anyway, it's Monday.
It is Monday, yes. And I'm excited for the news.
Can we go morning show for a second and talk about how delicious our coffee experience
was? You brought
in
some delicious maple coffee.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite good.
It's very fall.
We have discovered the joys of using a Keurig, but not using Keurig pods.
Yes.
And so that has freed us up for lots of delicious bulk coffee. Turns out in those pods, they don't necessarily use the best coffee.
That is so true.
Also horrible for the environment.
So exactly.
So we've moved beyond it.
We've moved beyond it. And we have this like really fancy coffee machine here, but I feel like the coffee from the work machine is a little too, I'm trying to do less sugar, less half and half.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be dressed up. It's a.
Yes. Also
it's
no
a
decaf.
Coffee lover's coffee.
Exactly.
You know, it's a.
Which we are. Okay, we love two things, justice and coffee.
We like coffee and milk. We like caffeine.
We love three things, justice, coffee, and milk.
Okay.
Occasionally
all right,
a donut on the
this
side.
That's enough Kelly and Michael.
Okay, consider that our debut, you know, maybe bring us on to ABC or something. Anyway, we've got other stuff not maple related that we're gonna be talking about. Should Donald Trump be impeached? No, if you ask Donald Trump or Pelosi. So we're gonna be talking about that. We've got two awesome interviews. Cost of Going to School, we're gonna be talking with the founder of Zero Hour. We're right between the two big climate strikes last Friday, which we attended in two different cities, and next Friday, so we're gonna be talking about that. We've got Greta Thunberg at the UN with an awesome speech. I like came close to tearing up while producing the news this morning because of that. Are you residue for Bernie Sanders? We'll help you figure that out a little bit later on.
Oh my goodness.
And we'll also be talking about the Emmys because we determine what's on the rundown and you can't stop us. So you can try, I guess, but Jodie Comer won, so I'm gonna talk about it. But anyway, with that, why don't we jump into the news, starting off with Donald Trump. Donald Trump and Ukraine, it's the big talk of DC and around the country, but will it actually lead to anything? Probably not, because we live in a hell world. And that frustrates a lot of people. One of them is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who got a lot of pushback, actually. She was attacked quite a bit over the weekend for tweeting this. At this point, the bigger national scandal isn't the president's law-breaking behavior, it is the Democratic Party's refusal to impeach him for it. See, I read that, I got a notification because she's one of like three people that I get notifications for her tweets for, and I said yes in response. And so it wasn't until a little bit later that I realized that many people thought that this was bad or wrong in some way, like how dare you question the strategy of the leadership of the House. I would say, how dare you not at this point?
Uh-huh.
She explained a little bit, saying, it is one thing for a sitting president to break the law, it's another to let him. The integrity of our democracy isn't threatened when a president breaks the law, it's threatened when we do nothing about it. The GOP's silence and refusal to act shouldn't be a surprise. Ours is. What possible argument against that is there at this point? That if you keep saying, how could Trump do this thing that I will totally let him keep doing for another year and change? That's what they're saying. They're saying it's okay. And I even got in my response to that, I had a couple of people, they're well-meaning people who were like, don't let, there's no, if you impeach him now, that gives him momentum in the election. Just wait, and like on the off chance that he wins, impeach him after.
But also,
you think it'll be easier to impeach him after he gets reelected than now?
And
that's madness.
It's something that you pointed out a while ago that I hadn't even thought of. It just hadn't even, like, I wasn't thinking of it this way, but you said this months ago. But that is, we can't only use, like, follow the rules when they benefit us.
Politically.
Exactly. And so that is using politics for your advantage. And that's absolutely against the rules. It should be. Is the president breaking the law? Is the president committing impeachable offenses? Then you've got to go for it, even if it could put you in jeopardy down the line. You have to.
Yeah. And is anything going to happen?
Right.
Is it? Well, big news over the weekend. Nancy Pelosi says Congress should pass new laws so sitting presidents can be indicted. new laws, even though she was also quoted this weekend as saying that the Department of Justice legal memo, it's not a law, the legal memo that implies that he can't be indicted by the Department of Justice when he's sitting as president, that is just a memo. It's not a law. She says it doesn't actually stop him from being indicted. So why are we gonna waste months passing laws that you yourself admit are not necessary to do what is required of you, your constitutional responsibility to provide a check on an out of control executive branch. It is just kicking the can down the road. That all it is, it's a time wasting thing. It's to get us a little bit closer to the election, because every month that passes, a few more people will be persuaded that we're getting really close to the election, we can't actually impeach him now, let's just wait until after. That's the whole point, that is what she's been doing. We are in month six of that strategy that Nancy Pelosi is pushing. And when it is clear that what Donald Trump is doing right now, on top of everything else, and there's a lot of stuff, what he's doing now is saying official US foreign aid to countries like Ukraine can be made contingent on you investigating the close family members, the immediate family members of my political opponents in an election. I mean, you either think that the president falls under some sort of legal obligations or you don't.
Right.
You either think we have a president or you're willing to accept us having a king. And right now, Donald Trump wants us to have a king. We get that. That's what he's wanted his whole life. Nancy Pelosi is willing to accept that. An imperial president unencumbered by any sort of legal consequences, whatever, for whatever he does. That's what she is saying. She's not saying that. That's what she's doing, which is far more important, of course. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating also to see much of the media immediately start playing the same games that we've played in the past. Donald Trump says to Ukraine, apparently, we'll give you this aid or whatever if you investigate him. Maybe it's not that explicit. He's saying now that he might actually release the transcript. And Dems are saying, we can't do anything until we see the transcript. I don't care what's on the transcript. It might not even be that explicit on the transcript. My point is, what is happening right now, what he is saying in the last few days is worse than whatever is supposed to be on the transcript, because he is making the case literally every day, up to and including this morning, that yeah, it's about corruption. I mean, why are we gonna give money to a country unless they look into corruption? Wink, wink. He's doing it in the open. I don't care what he said on the phone 2 months ago, he's doing it right now. And they're again hiding behind a report that might come out someday. And I'm sure that when the report comes out, it'll be taken very seriously by the Republicans. They will find anew their democratic responsibilities, and the media won't both sides it. There won't be any whataboutism if we just wait for the report. That's what's gonna happen. Again, they're just kicking the can down the road more.
Right.
And a lot of the media is like, okay, so I get your concerns. Donald Trump has been a really bad boy, but what if there's something to this Ukraine thing? What if there's something to this Biden thing? There is something to the Biden thing. You know what the Biden thing is? His son got a job because of who his father was. That is a story that we hear with virtually every elite in our system. That's the story. That is all that the story has. I'm gonna jump ahead to just a little bit of an explanation of this from Robert Mackey in The Intercept, who said, as a detailed review of the evidence conducted by The Intercept in May showed, Biden's intervention in Ukrainian affairs that year, when he successfully pressed Ukraine's then president to dismiss a chief prosecutor who had failed to pursue corruption investigations, was no secret and was widely praised by Ukrainian anti-corruption activists and international donors to the country. The reason there's footage of Biden boasting about this intervention on stage at a public event in 2018 is that he knew he had nothing to hide. And that was explicitly not an action that was taken to protect his son, because the son that in this theory has a patron who is a Ukrainian oligarch faced new potential investigations of corruption because the guy who hadn't been investigating it was being pushed out by Joe Biden. So under this theory, Joe Biden pushed out an investigator to protect his son by starting potentially an investigation of the guy who was paying his son. It makes no sense whatsoever, but if you just cloud it and you say a bunch of names that nobody knows and you have it drag out over a few weeks, you make it seem like, hey, maybe Trump has a legitimate beef here and he's not just manipulating a foreign country to raise the odds that he wins re-election. And everyone who goes along with this, some of them are good people, some of them are worried about corruption by our politicians, and they think, well, what if Biden did do something? That's fine. Look at the facts, understand that it is not what Trump is saying, and then move on to the serious threat to our country. Attempting to both sides this isn't just pursuing some sort of fake version of journalistic neutrality. It is doing the work of Donald Trump. It is being PR for Donald Trump in his attempts to do again in 2020 what he did in 2016. At this point, you know, I hesitated to tweet this because, you know, we're a little bit shy about, you know, tweets that could potentially get people riled up.
What were you gonna
but
say?
But it was just a version of, you know, like Donald Trump loved to brag about Fifth Avenue. Mm-hmm. I wonder at this time, I bet Trump could shoot a Democratic member of Congress on Fifth Avenue and she wouldn't impeach him over it.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, I don't think there's literally anything he could do.
I'm glad you didn't tweet that, but.
Yes. But is it not true?
Agree.
Is there anything that he could do that she'd be like, oh, we're doing it today?
I think that's, I get your frustration. Your frustration is that there is no line. That at this point, okay, this seems like the worst thing ever. And it's like, no, it's not. We have to wait for this. And then this happens. And then it's like, no, we have to wait for this. And then this happens. And
yeah.
It's like, no, we have to wait to see this. And then he goes and does an interview.
Yeah.
And just talks about it.
And just admits it.
Right,
just admits it.
No, I get it. It's like there is
we need a new speaker.
Line.
We need a new speaker. I wish that we could have one right now. That's apparently not something that we could have. And just a little heads up for the way that the rest of this election is going to go. When nothing comes of this, because nothing will, what do you think Donald Trump is going to do when he not only, like a few months ago, warned us, yeah, I would accept information from a foreign country. Here he's pressuring a foreign country to intervene in the election. And the Democratic leadership is going to say, well, what are you going to do? So what is Donald Trump going to do after? Something crazier.
Yeah.
Because he's being trained like a dog to do all the wrong things. And the person training him, it's not, you know, it's not like some, it's not Cheney. It's
not
some Republican.
It's Pelosi.
Essentially,
is what you're saying. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Anyway, just incredibly frustrating. We will see what will happen, which will be nothing after this. But we do have more show, which comes after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey there, welcome back to the Damage Report. I am Brooke Thomas and John is letting me lead this segment here because I'm so excited about this next guest. It is Assistant Professor of Education at Harvard Graduate School of Education, Anthony Abraham Jack. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon where you are, right? You're on the East Coast, so good afternoon.
How you doing? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. You wrote this amazing piece in the New York Times, and it's about college and your undergraduate experience. And I just want you to break down a little bit about what your article is about, because I think generally it was about the idea that getting to college and getting that tuition, your scholarship, getting the tuition taken care of, that's not enough by far. And a lot of students need a lot more support. Can you break that down for me?
Yeah, I mean, my main point is that access is not inclusion. People think that just because you have a financial aid package that covers most or all of your tuition, room and board, that's all that you need. I mean, the gaps between tuition and real life is real. I talked specifically about the fact that in my first spring semester, I didn't realize that the dining halls were going to close. I didn't realize that the campus assumed that everyone left for fun in the sun during spring breaks and other recesses, when if you didn't have the money to go home, or like some of my peers didn't have a home to go to, or who knew that home and harm were synonymous, you literally went hungry for 10 days. You scrounged for food. I worked extra hours in the gym to help pay to cover the cost of staying on campus, which most people don't think about. They think about the cost of leaving to go to a beach or to someplace fun, where some of us literally face food insecurity. I remember walking around campus and you pass the dining hall, the lights would be out, the chairs would be on top of the table. And literally, like, you would have to just find something to eat. And
there's that expectation. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just saying that there's that expectation that every kid, every student there will be taken care of for an entire week. And that is wild.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, in some respects, some consider people like at residential colleges fortunate because they only have these kind of breaks in basic needs like food and shelter during recesses. But this is a common reality for undergraduates, for students pursuing higher education all across the country. You know, estimates are as high as on average 40% of undergraduates in America are food insecure. And the number is even higher at our community colleges and our state colleges. And so we actually need to understand that just because you get that, what I call that fat envelope in the mail, right? That letter saying that you have been accepted, that's sometimes when the real struggle begins. Your basic needs are not necessarily calculated as part of your financial aid package. And we actually need to understand what that means.
This is John Adarola. I wanted to ask you, you talk about food insecurity, the ways that financial aid doesn't necessarily close the whole gap. In terms of like outcomes, like what the students are then, after all of this struggle throughout all the years of their college, are gonna get out of it and what happens to them in their career, what are some of the consequences of this?
See, the sad part is, we don't quite know in higher education. Like, we know what happens when kids are too hungry to learn in elementary, middle, and high school. We fought to put free and reduced lunch into school so students wouldn't be too hungry to learn. We just assume that just because a student is in college that they don't face the very same problem that they faced 3 months before. That's actually not true. So newer research is being done now about the consequences of food and housing insecurity on college campuses, but it's not something that we have actually tracked or pay attention to in any kind of scholarly way until most recently.
So what can be done? What can university leaders do at this point? What, as to start it, before we even have all the research, we know there's a problem. Yeah. What can be done and should be done, you know, in your opinion right now?
I mean, 100% basic meeting students' basic needs should be a priority for colleges and universities. Housing and food insecurity should not be something that keeps someone from walking across the stage at graduation. With respect to food insecurity, I think colleges and universities must tailor it to their student body. And what I mean by that is a school like Harvard and Amherst should expand their dining hall policy so that there are no breaks in the semester where students don't have access to basic needs, food and housing. Their residential campuses open the dining halls. But for campuses that are not residential or that are not where students aren't buying into the meal plan the same way, food banks and food pantries can be partial solutions, but we need national solutions. Mm-hmm. We need changes in access to SNAP, to different kind of institutional supports like food stamps and the like, so that students are, again, pursuing their degree without having the extra burden of finding where to eat or where to live.
Well, I definitely think everyone watching this, if they want more information, they should read your article. I was a low-income college student. Classes weren't the hard part, available on the New York Times. Anthony Abraham Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Greta Thunberg has hit the UN, and we'll see if they hit back after this. The Democratic primary, it's a complicated thing. And so when I want objective analysis of how everyone's doing, I turn to Nate Silver on Twitter. No, I'm kidding. he's
funny.
Got a problem with certain candidates. I'm not gonna say who. Moulton. No, I'm kidding. He doesn't like Bernie. Obviously, he doesn't like Bernie. He's very good when it comes to the numbers. When he starts putting words around them, though, that's when it starts to get a little bit problematic. And so I want to read a couple of tweets that he sent out. in attempting to respond to the new polling data that's been coming out, you know, out and out and out about Bernie Sanders' diverse base of support, especially in comparison to all the other candidates, but especially the front runners. And so how do you respond to that? Because the criticism last time had been that his base of support wasn't diverse enough. Now the evidence shows that it is. So presumably you learn and evolve and adapt. Or you could do this. Nate Silver tweeted, "Not sure Bernie should get credit for having more diverse support than last time, given that he has far less support than last time. A lot of voters have left him. White liberals have been particularly likely to leave him for Warren. So the residue of what's left is more diverse." And for some reason that I can't figure out, some people had an issue with him referring to the remaining diverse support of Bernie Sanders as a residue. Which isn't generally a term that we use for positive things. It's not like I ate almost all the ice cream. There's some delicious residue at the bottom.
Yeah.
It's not like, man, they plumbed most of the gold from that river. Now we've just got a little bit of golden residue. Generally, residue is disgusting, and so that was a poor choice of words, I think.
No, it was awful, and I am one who thinks like words matter, and your intent doesn't necessarily matter as much as the impact. And like calling a group of people of color residue is just kind of gross. And like everyone should just, when you have a public platform, be willing to, you know, speak, be not speak, but be more careful about the words you choose to use. So it was weird. The point he was trying to make was that these people don't matter, even though they're more diverse than before. It's because there's less people overall. I get it. I guess I get the point he was trying to make. It was weird. Even if you say what's left over, and which is essentially what he was trying to say, like this is just what's left over, it still doesn't take away the point. Was that like you're not connecting with these groups of people, right? That was the point initially. And then people are saying, no, now he is. And so then he was saying, no, they're just left over. Wouldn't it still matter that they are left over? Doesn't that prove the point that maybe he is connecting better? Right, yeah.
I think so. I think if you come at things 90% just talking about numbers, it might seem like, well, if you were to plot out mathematically, if there were five types of people and you had 20 of each, and then suddenly we took away 20, but it all came from one group, then the rest would be a bigger percentage. Okay, mathematically that sort of makes sense, but it doesn't make sense in terms of the actual example you're trying to present. What you're saying is he had a lot more support. Now he's losing the white liberals, and so what he's left over with looks more diverse. But what you're describing is a process where apparently when Bernie starts to lose people, the people who abandon him first are white liberals. So thereby, people who are not white liberals have a stronger, more durable attachment to Bernie Sanders. That's what you're describing. You're not describing it accurately.
Right, but that's the opposite of the point he's trying to make. And I think I find that fascinating.
I find much of what he does on Twitter to be fascinating. And look, I criticize him a lot, not because I hate him or he's a stupid shill or whatever. I read his articles and things like that. I think it's interesting. I don't do the sports stuff, but that's not about him. That's about sports. But sometimes he has some interesting stuff. It's his analysis on top of it that is bad.
It didn't make any sense. It didn't prove the point I think he was trying to prove. I think that the idea that the base is smaller overall, but the people of color stayed, that proves the point that the initial poster, the initial tweet that he was pushing back on. So, and we've already like broken that down. And then also, words matter. Residue was weird.
Residue is just a terrible term.
It was a terrible term. And just over and over and over, like people have got to think. And sometimes everyone makes mistakes, you know, but sometimes there's a reason you make certain mistakes. You've got to be willing to look into that.
Look, if you want to,
That's everybody across this political.
Me.
You don't make as many mistakes. Some.
I make mistakes
more than you should,
And I will continue to.
No, I'm just kidding. But
apologies in advance.
I definitely think that was so weird, because think about it. When you think about like how people of color are referred to and talked about over the course of this election period, just how the president talks about them, it's just like, oh my goodness, at least can we not be residue from somebody on our side?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I get it. It was a mistake. And I totally get what he was trying to say. I just shouldn't have to. I shouldn't have to constantly understand what someone meant when they said something or did something derogatory to people who look like me.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to be supremely understanding if it's not going to be reciprocated.
Yeah.
And here you appear to have identified a potential problem that you won't tweet about, which would be by your example, the two front runners, Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, have potentially a problem where their newfound support is disproportionately white. That seems like something to analyze. And I can say that as a person who doesn't, I don't despise Elizabeth Warren, but her support is more white as a percentage. That is a thing to discuss. It is not necessarily conducive to winning either the primary or the general election in the long run. So maybe consider talking about that a little bit. Now, I do want to turn to a very different topic, though, something that I saw that bothered me. I think it bothered a lot of people, and that has to do with Greta Thunberg.
Okay.
So Greta Thunberg is out there doing her thing, getting people to care about climate change. And as we've been talking about over the last few weeks, she is getting attacked nonstop for it. A lot of the attacks are incredibly deranged. And I would say sitting at the top of the deranged pile would be the historian who makes the very idea of studying history seem like a joke, Dinesh D'Souza. He tweeted this about Greta, saying, "Children, notably Nordic white girls with braids and red cheeks, were often used in Nazi propaganda. An old Goebbels technique. Looks like today's progressive left is still learning its game from an earlier left in the 1930s. So we were having a conversation before the show about the fact that it seems like if Greta wasn't from Sweden, if she was from Cameroon, then she might not be getting all of the praise and all the attention that she's getting.
She might not.
I 100% agree with that.
Right, yeah.
I also think it is impossible that she's getting the praise that she is because she's talking about climate change. But yes, I get that. That's a perfectly good point.
It's not what's going on here, though.
What's not a good point is the only reason she has been elevated, because again, none of this can ever be organic. It has to be that someone lurking in the background, and almost always when you scratch the surface enough, they think it's a Jewish billionaire, has elevated her because it's an old Nazi technique. And so they put a picture next to her, and they have braids, and so that tells the story, which is odd because other people on Twitter have said it's not actually difficult to do that in a lot of other examples. So if you, for instance, take that same picture of the girl with the braids and you put it up against the Kent State gun girl, she's got braids. Is she doing that to use Nazi terminology? Hell, she even has a gun. I looked into it. The Nazis love guns. That would be unfair to make that comparison. You could do that with other people too. Take another picture of Nazi propaganda, put it next to Mike Pence, and I don't know, the white hair, strong jawline, Der Deutsch student, I don't know. I'm not saying anything, I'm just saying. Hell, you could even do it with Dinesh D'Souza. If you take a picture of him and put it next to a hardened criminal, that will look similar.
Oh,
wait, that's the same thing because he's a criminal.
Out of line, John Iadarola.
He's a criminal.
No, right.
Is he? Nazi propaganda. So look, what you could do is argue against Greta on the merits. You could do that. They're choosing not to do that. We'll have to figure out for ourselves why it is that they refuse to actually engage in that sort of battle. But the idea that she's only been elevated because it's a Nazi technique, that's unproductive. If you want to point out why do we listen to certain types of voices and not others, and what can we do to create some equality there, that's productive and thus not something Dinesh D'Souza is likely to be involved in.
Also, listen, this is a child. Where are your inner morals? This is a child. This is a child, and she's not doing anything harmful. Let's say that all of them are right, and the world is not burning. Let's say that there's nothing happening, no problem, the world is not burning. Being more environmentally friendly is not gonna harm anybody. It's not a problem. Also, you are the side in power right now. You're ignoring the scientists, let alone the children. If your boss, like your leader, can ignore actual scientists, why can't you ignore a child?
Yeah.
This is a child. And there was this other woman who tweeted, this talk radio host in London who tweeted a picture of this child and wrote, "Hi Greta, I've just booked some long haul flights for my family to enjoy some winter sun on the beach this Christmas. Level of guilt being felt, 0%. This is a child. What is wrong with you that a child—
Oh, you just destroyed that kid.
Right, it's a child, that a child has you so worked
up. Exactly.
That you want to be nasty to her, to a child. She's not causing any harm whatsoever.
No,
even
she's
if
doing
you
the opposite.
Do not agree with what she's fighting for, it does not cause any harm. That's it. Like, that is absurd. Even if you like bacon and you're a lifelong bacon eater, a vegetarian does not hurt you.
Yeah, that, I agree.
This is wild that people are so upset by somebody wanting us to take care of this earth better that they start beating up on a child.
Yeah.
That you cannot be in support of that. But then also, this is like the party of babies in cages, and so I don't even know
level of guilt being felt over babies in cages.
Right, so you're 0%. Right. Actually, forget everything I just said.
Yeah.
I
already have. No, I'm kidding. So she also was at the UN. We're gonna do that a little bit later on.
Yeah.
Awesome video from her, surprisingly undeterred by Dinesh D'Souza's attacks. Anyway, we are gonna take a break.
Baby.
We come back more on the environment after this. Last Friday, I was lucky enough to be able to attend one of the climate strike rallies in downtown LA. Massive rallies all over the world, actually. Massive attendance too. And coming up on this Friday, there's going to be another climate strike. If you have the ability to take part, I definitely think that you should. And please bear in mind that these events, they come to us thanks to the amazing organizing work of some, in many cases, incredibly young organizers. And so that's why I'm very excited to welcome to the show Jamie Margolin, who's only 17 years old, but the founder of Zero Hour. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us, especially now. This is an incredibly important time for organizations like yours. Can you tell us about Zero Hour?
Yeah, so Zero Hour is a youth climate justice organization. We started in the summer of 2017. Initially, I had the idea of a massive youth climate mobilization, but I didn't know how to make it happen. I didn't know what to do. And what I did, so I posted on Instagram. This was right after Hurricane Maria. This was right after these massive wildfires that blew in Canada, blew over my home city of Seattle, completely covering my city in smog, making me sick, and making my friends with respiratory illnesses like sent to the ER. So I posted on social media, I'm going to organize a youth climate march. Who's with me? This was in the summer of 2017. A few kids got back to me, and over the course of that year, we organized 25 youth climate marches to take place on July 21st of 2018, and they were a massive success. Zero Hour movement expanded. We had many youth mobilizations demanding for urgent action on climate change because this is Zero Hour to act. We have no more time. And after that, a month later, Greta Thunberg started her school strike, and then we were continuing to organize around the strikes, but also organize, we organized a youth climate action summit on July 21st of 2018. On July of 2019 in Miami, Florida, to train many young people to be climate justice activists there. And we've just been continuing educating, and we're a network and powerhouse of young people, mostly young women in high school, organizing and building for a better world.
So I'm curious, you got involved in this effort, as you pointed out, around the same time that there were some other people in a similar sort of position in their life, starting organizations or going it alone, in Greta's case. And since 2017, it seems like there's a lot more discussion around climate change. There's a lot more interest in these movements. I am very cynical on this topic. I fear that the politicians will they'll clap, but they won't necessarily do anything.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how optimistic are you? Are you afraid of this moment, sort of cresting and then eventually falling away? What do you think is likely to happen?
So the organizing and the work is never going to crest and fall away, because we've been doing this for years and years, and we will continue doing this for years and years. My worry is whether the media and politicians will continue to actually pay attention, because we have always been here, we have always been organizing, and we will continue to organize when the cameras are off. But we need the cameras to stay on in order for the general public and people to completely understand and to take action. My other fear is that Zero Hour just spent an entire 3 days nonstop before the climate strike in Capitol Hill lobbying and talking to leaders. We met for an hour with House Leader Nancy Pelosi. We met with the wonderful Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We met with many different offices. And I testified before Congress. And, people will come up to me and they'll say, great job. They'll be like, very great speech, very moving. And they'll call us inspiring. But then they won't actually act, and then they won't actually take any legislative action or anything from there. So my worry is that it's just empty words.
I think that's a very justified worry. I can't speak for all of the media, but I pledged a long time ago that it doesn't matter if every video I do on climate change gets 1/10 the interest of any other topic. I'm gonna keep doing it.
Exactly.
And hopefully it'll make a difference to the extent that we can. From your organization, what would you say are some of your core demands?
So our core demands, well, first of all, are addressing the root systems of oppression that caused the climate crisis in the first place. So addressing the colonialism, racism, and unchecked patriarchy and capitalism that is really at the root of this climate crisis. And that seems very strange to people. It seems like overly progressive, like Fox News' worst nightmare, like the exact archetype of what a snowflake liberal would be talking about. But these aren't things that I enjoy talking about. This is just the facts. The truth is that the climate crisis started really with colonization, that idea that everything is for our extraction, that everything is for sale, that everything can be bought and sold, including our fellow people and the land that we depend on. And so that mindset and that way of living really started, like, you know, I'm not, when I say modern capitalism, I think business and trade and things like that have always been good. I'm talking about like that modern, like mega corporations on steroids, owning everything, yeah, abusing people, abusing the earth, and not being checked. That's what I'm talking about when I say capitalism, because, you know, Breitbart will freak out and be like, she wants to start the communist revolution. Calm down. No, I don't. but it's just like, we have to address this. And right now our current economic system is set on a trend where we just have constant growth, 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 and our earth just can't sustain that. And then another concrete demand, so those are like at the roots of what we're demanding. And so right now our current most concrete demand, we're behind, you know, supporting for a Green New Deal and bringing about the era of the Green New Deal, not as an end all be all, but as a very important step in the right direction. And also, you know, divesting our government and divesting politicians from the fossil fuel and animal agriculture industries, because the biggest thing that is stopping them from taking action to protect our lives and futures is really just, they owe the animal agriculture and fossil fuel industries so much. So then they, you know, then they don't really have a big check on them when they go turn around and destroy the Amazon rainforest and my life and future.
Yeah, it is a diverse coalition of corporate interests that are fighting both explicitly and behind the scenes against this sort of movement. If people would like to get involved in your organization, what should they do?
So you should go to thisiszerohour.org, where you can sign up, become a part of the movement. It really depends. Like, for young people, you can follow us on social media at thisiszerohour. Actually, anyone can, but you can follow us there and send us a message in our social media bio. We have a link right now. We have a new campaign called Getting to the Roots of the Climate Crisis. So, or hashtag Get to the Roots, where we, it's not new. We've been doing this for a year, but we recently announced the scale up at the UN Youth Climate Summit the other day. And so we're training young people to be climate justice ambassadors, to address the root systems of oppression of climate change in their communities and educate their peers. So you can go to at This Is Your Hour on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to join that campaign, and also to stay updated for our other campaigns, marches, and initiatives. And then for anyone, you can go to thisiszerohour.org for more information, to read our platform, and thisiszerohour.org/donate to please donate to us, because we are a completely volunteer run organization that relies on grassroots donations up against a very literally well-oiled machine with the deepest pockets in the world. I always call the fossil fuel and animal agriculture industries the most well-funded criminal enterprises in the world. Like, the fossil fuel industry is a very well-funded criminal enterprise, and that's all they are.
With a quote like that, you might end up on Laura Ingraham tonight. We'll have to see. Jamie Margolin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but stick around. More after this. Greta Thunberg is at the UN today for the climate panel, and her testimony was as powerful as you'd expect it to be.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
We got more video, but that's something. I mean, yeah, Edwin, that Where are the politicians who can say something even approaching that in terms of both understanding the synthesis of different areas of politics that come together to create the crisis that we're in, and to be able to speak about it in that passionate a way, that professional way, that mature way?
She gets it more than your average politician. And
yeah,
it should be that upsetting. It should have you shaken like yeah, that. The earth is burning.
Yeah.
And yeah, not only that, but that should shake you enough, period. But that so many people in power don't seem to care.
Yeah.
And so I understand her passion.
And or at least don't care enough and are not willing to say that thing that she said at the end. I don't want to pass over that. If your only focus is on money and what she says, the fairy tale of eternal economic growth, that is cowardice to be unable to question that. The idea yeah, that we will chase that over a cliff if need be. That's horrible, but that is what many politicians are too scared to ever question. I don't think that switching over to something like Green New Deal, instituting it, I don't think that that has to do much damage to our economy. But if it did, fine, that's fine, if that's what saves our species and our civilization. But there are people who are far more worried about some ad being run against them or losing a little bit of their donations. It stops them from actually acknowledging that.
Yeah.
Now, I wanna show a little bit more of this from the conclusion of our address today.
There will not be any solutions or plans presented in line with these figures here today, because these numbers are too uncomfortable and you are still not mature enough to tell it like it is. You are failing us, but the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Ah, jeez, man. Like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it like that. And I know everywhere she goes, including that room, there's probably a lot of people who are like, you know what? In an ideal world, I would like to do something about this. And so Greta, great job, Greta. But mm-hmm, she doesn't accept that, and she shouldn't accept that.
Yeah, no, I think she's great. And I don't know what it is. Are they just smarter than us? Like this younger generation, are they? I still like to think of myself as the younger generation. That's another conversation.
Younger
but
than me.
No, jokes aside, they just get it.
Mm-hmm.
And is it, do you think it's because we didn't grow up knowing this, like didn't grow up having this information like right in our faces? So we had to come to grips with it and then make it make sense, and now then try to work towards doing something about it. They have learned this almost from jump. Like, hey, this is going on around you.
On this particular issue, mm-hmm, I don't know if when I was 16 or 15, because you know, she was obviously interested before she started the movement. When I was 14 or 15, could I have done it on this issue? I don't know.
Would you?
But there were issues.
Yeah.
There could have been some other issue.
Yeah.
And I think it's, I think that the next generation does get it more. I think that she and a few of the other leaders gets it especially. But again, when we show these videos, I wanna make sure that we're not doing the thing that she criticizes, which is let's watch this video and feel inspired by her and then we're good. We're not good. That's 0.5% of the way. The rest of it is actually doing something. And I try to make this point in literally everything that we do with the Damage Report, but especially on this issue. If what you do when you're passionate about politics is watch a show, whether mine or another, and then that's it, I've failed. That other show has failed. If that is the extent of what it drives you to do, that should be the ground floor. That should be the door opening to actually doing something, organizing, getting active, pushing for your values to be put into effect in policies. The real world, not just the entertainment side of this thing. And she, I think, stresses that better than perhaps anyone else.
I agree.
Okay, very powerful stuff from her. We're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Last night was the 2019 Emmys.
Oh, Billy Porter, I love that. I love that moment. moment. Yeah.
There you go. We're going to talk about that moment and other moments. I watched it. Brooke, you watched it as well?
I did the whole thing. I actually live tweeted, not live texted it with my friend Stacy. We were too lazy to actually go to one another's homes.
Yeah.
So we texted each other during
it. That's something. I live tweeted it to some extent.
Yeah,
and
me
discovered
too, a little bit,
that among the many things that my Twitter followers don't care what I think about, the Emmys is high up on that list.
Which is weird because you like a lot of television, and I feel like the biggest complaint that I saw online from a lot of people were, what are all these shows? Who are these people? And they were all shows that I guarantee you John Iadarola has watched.
The ones that
people were like, what is
this? Well, I watch a lot of shows that are not gonna be nominated for Emmys anytime soon.
Really? I feel like all your big ones did really well.
We'll see. Game of Thrones. We'll see Dark Crystal next year, we'll find out. Yeah, Game of Thrones did well.
What's the one who won everything that swept the Comedy
Fleabag.
Awards?
Fleabag. Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Loved that, and Chernobyl.
Chernobyl did very well. Yeah, so Phoebe Waller-Bridge won three of the biggest awards.
Uh-huh.
And I'm starting to think that it's kind of unfair that she has found some way to psychically take all of the talent from everyone around her and just hoard it for herself. That's what I think is happening. I was very happy to see Game of Thrones win for best drama in their last season. I understand that there's a lot of haters for the season, but they won.
Of Fleabag?
No, of Game of Thrones, the last season.
Oh, Game of Thrones, right. I mean, you were one of those haters.
I was a realist. Okay. I understood its actual limitations. It did not feel like if I go 5%, I have to imply that it's the worst TV that's ever existed.
I don't want to get us back into the Game of Thrones conversation.
But Jodie Comer won for Killing Eve, an amazing performance. But look, this is all important and good. But there were some great speeches and some important moments that I wanted to shed light on.
Let's do it.
Talk about it a little bit. One of them you alluded to was Billy Porter's historic win.
Love Billy Porter.
For limited series drama. So part of Billy Porter's speech was, visibility and representation are the only things that create change. It's when we're visible that we have the power to create empathy through the way we tell stories. Being black and gay and out and being in this position and speaking from where I get to speak from is the change. I hope that young queer people of all colors can look at me and know that they can. And I know for a lot of people that Twitter blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime Billy Porter's on stage, it blew up.
I know,
but especially
I just got
blew
the chills.
Then.
Billy Porter is everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I haven't actually watched the show. It doesn't have dragons or elves in it, so it's lower down my list, but especially now.
You don't like good TV, and that's just the weirdest thing about you.
I like very specific escapist
TV. You don't like good television.
I like The Boys. The Boys is good.
You complained about a TV show with Idris Elba in it.
What show?
Was it like Good Luck Charlie or something like that? What was it called?
No, I didn't complain about
you
that.
You didn't like it?
No, I didn't say that.
I was
going
to say, because I loved it. And I just
I know you binged it.
I did. I loved it.
I liked him, in The Office. But anyway,
the show wasn't very diverse. Listen, there were less nominations from diverse nominees than last year.
There were a lot of shows that popped up over and over.
Let's get to the long list of black winners. Okay, Billy Porter, Darrell Jerome, RuPaul.
Yes.
Oh, that's the end of the list. Sorry. I thought it seemed like you thought there were going to be more than
three. You nailed it, actually. Yeah. Darrell Jerome had a great moment, by the way. The standing ovation
when
for the Exonerated Five.
Should have swept the awards. Get real.
Yeah.
It was directing. Some of the most, just some of the greatest television that I've ever seen. Mm. It was a true story that was just done so well. I am glad that he was able to win for episode 4 because the performance was spectacular. Like the feeling that you got watching that, it was unreal.
Yeah. There were just some shows that I feel like I didn't watch
Chernobyl
Ozark.
Best?
Apparently, everybody who votes in this loves Ozark.
Yeah.
Like Gwendolyn Christie didn't win for best supporting actress in a drama because of Ozark. I haven't seen Ozark, maybe it's amazing, maybe that actress is the best ever.
A lot of people really like Ozark, and like so much Ozark
Chernobyl.
And Succession are two shows that I'm bummed that I just didn't get into. Because I like
I
to watch
Succession.
Good TV and I like shows. You didn't like it?
No.
I tried.
I don't want to see that world, I'm not interested in that world.
I don't like
shows that are about businesses, and I don't really like shows that are about the music industry, and I know that that's a lot of TV shows.
I liked Weeds, that was a show about a business.
I didn't watch that either. Now I want to give another, really fast, Michelle Williams, who won for
such a strong moment.
Is it Fosse Verdon?
Is that how you say it? Posse
I'm not
Verdon?
Sure. I didn't watch that either.
Posse Verdon.
I can't watch everything, okay?
It's all right. It's all right.
I'm watching Carnival Row. I can't watch everything. Okay, anyway, so Michelle Williams said, thank you so much to FX and Fox 21 Studios for supporting me and for paying me equally, because they understood that when you put value into a person, it empowers that person to get in touch with their own inherent value. And then where they do put that value, they put into their work. And so the next time a woman, and especially a woman of color, because she stands to make 52 cents on the dollar compared to their white male counterpart, tells you what she needs in order to do her job, listen to her, believe her, because one day she might stand in front of you and say thank you for allowing her to succeed because of her workplace environment and not in spite of it. That was a great moment.
That was a great moment. Yeah. It was a great moment, yeah. That made me want to go back and watch Fosse Verdon. I actually Googled it and was like, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how I missed that.
Yeah, I don't even know what's on, actually.
Yeah, me either.
I'm not sure. Right. Super fast, I just want to say Alex Borstein won for her role in Marvel's Miss Maisel.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. That moment when she said, she told a story about, so her, I think it was her grandmother, was in line to be shot into a pit as a Holocaust survivor. She said to a guard, what happens if I step out of line? The guard said, I don't have the heart to shoot you, but somebody will. And she stepped out of line. For that, I am here and my children are here. So step out of line, ladies. Step out of line. I got chills.
Okay, one more at the moment. Jeez. How funny she is. Jeff Bezos actually texted her and said, like, I'll be rooting for you from the audience. And she was like, great, but actually I have some dog food that I need to return. And he said, bring it to the ceremony. Oh, she was like, can you take care of that for me? This was a funny moment.
That was good. No, she's very funny.
She's great, yeah.
Yeah, there were some great winners. Not all the ones the way I wanted, but overall, pretty good Emmys. And good distraction from the politics of the day.
We needed it.
Thank you as always.
Yeah.
Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you everybody for watching. Lots planned coming up this week. In fact, RoCon will be returning to the show tomorrow, as well as Emma Vigeland and more. So we'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.